What's up? I'm John Wall.
And I'm CJ Toledano, and we're starting a new podcast presented by DraftKings called Point Game.
Because you know, like at camps and stuff like this, you take the ball out, you ain't getting the ball back. Like, you the last one up the court, they already did their thing. So I stopped there, and I just got into a rhythm and started hooping.
The Lakers should sign Trae Young this summer.
They got to kind of start preparing for, like, if LeBron's last year is this year or next year, whenever it is. And I feel like a pick and roll with AD and a guy like Trae Young would be deadly.
Check out Point Game with John Wall and CJ Toledano on the iHeartRadio app, DraftKings YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Parents, if you've ever experienced bedtime battles with the kids, I'm going to let you into a little secret. The Koala Moon podcast has revolutionized over 20 million bedtimes, with parents like you calling it life-changing and the perfect nighttime routine. With original kids' bedtime stories and cozy sleep meditations, every episode has been specially designed to make bedtimes a dream. Listen to Koala Moon on the iHeartRadio app, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Discover a new educational and interactive podcast, Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids. Our episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, yes! We went shape hunting around the block, and we found spheres and cubes on the street.
That was great fun. Join Stories for Kids, the Lingo Kids podcast, inspiring you to learn while having fun. Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to All the Smoke, a production of The Black Effect and iHeartRadio in partnership with Showtime.
Welcome back, man. Season 2 of All the Smoke.
We got a real special guest.
What's up with you, Brody, with the virtual handshake?
I'm going to tell y'all something that I never told nobody.
I want All the Smoke.
Welcome back, Season 2, All the Smoke, with our new partner, iHeart. It's a pleasure for me to introduce strictly just one of my favorite humans. Former teammate of mine, good friend of mine, big fan of what he's doing off the court as well. Welcome, JJ Redick.
What's up, bro? What's up, guys? Thank you for having me.
Appreciate you being here.
Thanks for coming on, man. Appreciate you.
I feel the same way about you, Matt. I feel the same way about you.
My God.
You're a hell of a human.
Funny story, like, and it really made me change my thinking, period, because JJ, you, and most Duke guys have this, like, there's that stigma of Duke guys, and you were the ultimate Duke guy, you know, all-time leading scorer, accolade, a list of accolades, but I looked at him, I'm like, he just seems like he'd be an asshole. And that's just what I thought. I didn't know anything about you, never met you. Teammate, ended up being teammates with you in Orlando, and it just completely flipped my thinking on literally prejudging someone before I met him. I tell you, like in 2009, that was really my wake-up call because I thought, oh, this guy's probably whatever. Met you, one of the nicest, most humble, hardest working people I've ever met, man, and it's an honor to call you a friend, and like I said, have you on the show today. We appreciate you.
I appreciate that, man. I remember when we met, too, because it was we were doing Jameer Nelson's week in Philadelphia. He would have everybody... Yep. In August, come to Philly, and you had just signed with us, and I probably had some preconceived notions of you too. Let's be honest.
That's what I'm talking about.
The first night I roll in, and I was probably a couple of days late, but I rolled in, and we went to this sushi place in Philly, and I was like, "Yo, Matt is the coolest dude I've ever met." Like I was like, right away, I knew we'd be friends.
That's what's up, man. Hey, for life. There you go. Well, let's jump right into it. You got a chance to experience the NBA bubble. I liked the safe environment they built. I like that you guys continue to keep the social justice message going, and other things that apply to that. But talk to me about that because you were someone who obviously were stuck in the bubble for a while. Didn't have your kids, didn't have your wife. How did all that kind of mix with going and playing and being away from your family?
Yeah, I think being away from the family was the hardest part. It's not really normal to be away from your wife and kids for basically 7 weeks because, you know, we had to quarantine for 2 weeks in New Orleans. I lived with Drew Holiday when his family stayed in California. So we were together for like 2 weeks in New Orleans, and then we went to the bubble for 5 weeks. So just being away from them was really hard. But if you look at the bubble, it's been an overwhelming success. Look, we've had high-level basketball. We've gotten all the way to the finals. There's been no COVID outbreak, not one whatsoever. You know, we had some COVID positives on arrival. Since then, we've had zero. Knock on wood. And, you know, I think the players have shown that we are going to be relentless with our social justice messaging. Mm-hmm. Some of it, I think, has been really powerful. I've said this a bunch of times, man. I'm proud of my peers. I'm proud of our league and what we've been able to do over the last few months.
The conversations that was going on, you know, inside the bubble, I know you can't tell us everything, but with me, I seen that some people actually didn't want to play at all and some did. Like, was it more on the side of standing not to play, or was it more on the side of saying, you know what, hey, we got to go out here and play because our message is being heard more while we're playing?
There was a few phone calls prior to us going down to Orlando that I was on. I was on one call on like a Friday or Saturday night in June with about 90 guys. There were definitely a few media members on the phone too. I don't know how they ended up getting a call in for that Zoom call. But, you know, we talked about this, and there was definitely a group of guys who felt like we shouldn't play. And then there was an overwhelming part of the league felt like this was an opportunity to further messaging, to bring more awareness. Mm-hmm. Look, if we hadn't, my argument to that is like, if we hadn't played, what is taking over the news cycle? You know, nobody's talking about NBA players if we're not playing. That's not how it works. That's not how it works at all. You know, we're going to talk about Trump being an idiot, the election, and as soon as football starts, that's all anybody cares about.
Mm-hmm. Football.
So we're gonna have 2 months in July and August where we control the news cycle. And I thought, you know, the messaging early on was great. I thought some of the announcements were really, really important. You know, the social action fund that D. Wade and Mello and CP started, Malcolm Brogdon started a family foundation. The league announced a partnership with the PA to basically invest $300 million in Black communities. Like, those are real things. Mm-hmm. Those are things beyond just wearing a T-shirt or kneeling, in front of the flag for the national anthem. Those are real things. Those are things that are going to have legitimate impact in communities. And then the stuff with voting, I think, has been great. I have no prediction for November 3rd, but I think the messaging that the league has had, that the PA has had, our players have had about just participating in this electoral process has been really important. And I think, as we saw with the Breonna Taylor case, our elected officials are the people that are making the laws. So we need to get the right elected officials in office to make the laws that reflect what the majority of Americans want.
And that's what I talk about, too, when I tell people voting. It's just not on the federal level, because just as you said, it's on the local and state level. You know, the AG, the AD, the judges, the mayor, all these are elected positions that... Right. You know, come November 3rd, we have an opportunity to vote on. So that's why I've been so adamant about voting, like I said, not just on the federal level, but on your local and state level.
Hey, can I just interject real quick? I just want to interject real quick, because I think people have a ton of questions about voting. And I was literally having this conversation with my friend last night in my kitchen. It's one of the fucking most complicated things in the world. And there's so much uncertainty and clarity about all these issues. And the rules are different state to state. I know you guys are doing a lot of stuff with voting. I just want to plug one thing real quick. I want to plug Vote Save America. VoteSaveAmerica.com/register. There's information on all 50 states. It's a 2 to 3 minute process to answer any questions you have about voting and to get yourself registered. It's the easiest thing. My wife hadn't been registered since we moved to New York a couple years ago. I wanted to switch where I was registered, New York. I did it the other day. It took 2 minutes. Like, please just go votesaveamerica.com/register. It's the easiest thing.
Dope. And we'll definitely put that up, too, when we air this episode, so everyone will know that. We appreciate that. With the NBA playoffs being what they were, very entertaining, very exciting. We're to the finals now. You got a chance to play with Jimmy. Talk to us about what it was like playing with him, and then when he left Philly to Miami, your thoughts.
Yeah. Well... So I love playing with Jimmy. He's an interesting personality. And I think oftentimes with Jimmy, it can rub certain people the wrong way. And Matt, you and I play with CP, and they're different personalities, but CP was similar in that way. Like, if you didn't get CP, I could see where he would rub you the wrong way. I fucking love playing with CP. I love playing with Jimmy. You know, in my opinion, I wish we had just ran it back in Philly. But it was clear that they felt like they had to go in a different direction with both, you know, him and with me. And, you know, I don't have
horrible moves. Yeah. Both horrible moves.
I don't have any regrets about my decision last summer. I didn't have any regrets. I had an unbelievable time in New Orleans. Clearly, Jimmy has no regrets about, you know, his decision. Like, it's worked out. He ended up in the perfect situation for him. You know, he's in an environment that just, like, promotes everything that he's about. And he can just be himself and be comfortable. And that rubs off because he does have an amazing personality, and that just rubs off on everyone else. It's been awesome to watch. I give so much love to the Heat on my podcast. Everybody thinks I'm going to the Miami Heat in 2021. Like, it's not about that. It's just about as a fan, like, I just appreciate what they've been able to do. They never tanked. They've always been able to just pivot very quickly and maintain this winning environment and this winning culture. And when you get the right mix of players and the right mix of personalities, that leads to being a championship contender, which they are this year.
That's interesting the way you put that, too, because Jack has a relationship with Jimmy Butler, and I've only known him as an opponent. I would ask Jack, like, what Jimmy was like, because I always kind of wondered. Sometimes he'd say some crazy shit, then I'd see him say some amazing things, and all I know that he played hard, and he's probably the most blue-collar superstar we have in this league.
Jack, what is your... Like, what's your relationship with Jimmy? That goes back to Houston?
Yeah, you know, me being a little older and him watching me and me making it, you know, he kind of looked up to me a little bit to the point where we got to the league. And I was kind of a mentor to him because our attitudes and where we approach the game is the same. You know, a lot of people didn't understand me. They said I was this and I was that, you know, but one thing they couldn't say is I couldn't play basketball. And that was what me and Jimmy had similar. We both loved the game. We both played with a lot of passion. And I see a lot of myself in Jimmy. Jimmy's just way more stronger, way more athletic than me. But, you know, the way we approached the game is what we had in common. And it brought us to the point where we have like a brotherhood now. We talk all the time, and I'm one of his biggest fans.
Yeah, you bring up bigger calves than him with just a player's reputation, and you guys know this because we've all switched teams a number of times, and so you're going into a locker room or a guy gets traded into your locker room, and that guy carries with him whatever the book says that he is, right?
Yeah, right.
And I think as teammates in the NBA, it's our responsibility to give every guy sort of a fair shot and give every guy a clean slate. Yep. And I've tried to do that throughout my career. I'm glad Matt gave me a chance back at 09. I'm glad Matt gave me a chance. But, you know, it's funny because, like, you know, Jimmy carried with him this reputation from Chicago and from Minnesota.
Yeah.
And within 2 weeks of him being in Philly, I'm like, you know, I'm going to go hang with this guy. Like, I'm going to go to every meal on the road. I'm with Jimmy. Like, it's interesting how reputation isn't always reality.
Right.
And I think both of you guys, because I played with Jack, too, in L.A. with the Clippers.
Yeah,
Jack had a quick stop with us for a 10-day.
I told him about that. You made me sell. I had a conversation with you about a watch. I remember walking in the locker room one day. I just bought me a new diamond watch, Matt. You know, I'm letting it hang, too, because I want everybody
and
to see
shit,
it.
And he shit all over it.
Oh, my God. Hey, JJ, he just quietly sits on the side of me and gets to explain to me about my watch, what kind of watches I need to have on, how much they cost, and how much my watch I had on wasn't shit. I went and sold them all real shortly after that.
He's a watch dude. It made me feel good because I had a watch that he really liked, and I wouldn't sell it to him. Then I ended up losing that bitch. I should have just sold it to him. But he really liked it, and I wouldn't sell it to him. Man. I'd wear it around him all the time, and he wanted to buy it, and I wouldn't sell it to him. Then I lost that fucking thing.
I heard you got rid of all your watches, though, JJ.
Yeah, I did. Hold on. It was, Matt, was that that was the watch that C-Webb gave you?
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that. That was when we played in Orlando. I tried to get that watch off you a few times.
Yeah,
Jack, I sold everything, man. You ever heard that? You ever heard the phrase "your possessions shouldn't possess you"?
Yes, yes.
I got to man, with watches where it was like an all consuming thing. And I mean, you guys have both been around me. Like, I have an obsessive and an addictive personality. Mm. When I'm really into something, I just go all out on it, and it's one of the reasons, you know, I've had a long basketball career because that is my first love, but. You know, I got into watches so hard, man. It was taking up too much of my time. Mm-hmm. And it got to the point where I'm like, yo, this is such a selfish pursuit. You know, it's like no one's getting any enjoyment out of this except me. Like my wife's not benefiting from this. My kids aren't, like my friends aren't. Like I'm the only person wearing the watches.
Yeah, yeah.
JJ was sleeping with them motherfuckers. He had to get rid of them. The wife told him it's either her or the watches.
Yep.
Growing up in Roanoke, Virginia, when did basketball kick in for you?
I would say I became obsessed with it and like loved it when I was 12, 13. So like basically seventh grade. And that was the year that I quit baseball. And I was probably better at baseball, truthfully, than I was at basketball at the time. But my dad kind of was just like, you don't have time to do both. And so growing up, like my idols were my older sisters. I have older twin sisters. So when I was super young, they rode horses competitively. So I learned how to ride a horse. Then they started playing softball. So I started playing baseball. And then when they were 13, they were like 6'1". So they started playing basketball. They ended up getting a D1 ride to a small school in North Carolina called Campbell. So when they started playing basketball at 13, that's why I started playing at 8. And by the time I was 12 or 13, I was pretty good. And then I hit a growth spurt. I broke my wrist 3 times in 6 months. And when my wrist was broken, I just shot one-handed. And from that point on, you know, I was a great shooter, and I was addicted. And the shooting part of basketball for me is the drug. I mean, seeing that ball go through the hoop, it's the drug.
Absolutely. Obviously, a very decorated high school career, McDonald's All-American, state champion, scored 43 points in the championship game. Those are your Al Bundy days. Recruited, you ended up choosing Duke. What was it about Duke that spoke right to you?
What, my Al Bundy days?
You know, when he reminisces about his Polk High days. Oh. I used to do this in high school and do that in high school, but you really had the accolades.
Yeah. Honestly, I mean, I was a Duke fan since I was like 8, since I first started playing basketball. And my first year of basketball was when they had won their second national championship against I guess it was Michigan that year. Yeah, because in 91 they beat Kansas. So they beat Michigan in 92, and I probably watched that game like 20 times. Somebody had taped it on VHS at our house, and then it ended up getting taped over by The Sound of Music. I was fucking pissed. I was so pissed. I had that game memorized for like 2 years.
That's dope.
And so it was like, by the time I got to high school, man, like I was getting recruited by a lot of teams, you know, like UVA, and I was from Virginia, so UVA was on me hard, and Texas, Stanford. Billy Donovan was at Florida at the time, and I was really interested in going there. But it was always a situation where if Coach K and Duke had made me an offer, like I was going to go there. It was the hardest part for me was saying no to UVA, because I did feel some sense of loyalty. My family had lived in Charlottesville for a few years before we moved to Roanoke. And, you know, I had some friends that were going to go to UVA. My best friend in high school was going to go play baseball and football there. So that was the hardest part, was just saying no to them. But going to Duke was the dream come true. You know, I didn't really bat an eye. It was like, you have a chance to come. Here's your offer. And then like 3 days later, I called Coach K and I said, all right, I'm coming.
That's dope. I mean, with the rich history at Duke, with all the All-Americans and NBA players they turned out, you know, 2-time ACC Player of the Year, all-time Duke leading scorer. What was your experience like there? And tell us about Coach K and what it was like playing with him, and what did you learn from him?
I feel like I had two chapters of my Duke career. And it was, you know, my freshman and sophomore year and my junior and senior year. And my first chapter was really hard. This was the chapter that made Matt Barnes think I was an asshole. and most of America thought I was an asshole. You know, you're 18 years old as a freshman, and I played in a lot of big games, but it's never in front of fans. And you go on your first road game, and it's at Clemson. You're like 12 games into your freshman year, and the entire student section is yelling profanities at you. I had in college my first 2 years, I had this like bad acne and shoulder acne, and so you see kids like wearing these mock Duke number four jerseys, and they've painted these red dots all over their shoulders, and there's signs about your family, and you're like, holy shit, what did I just sign up for? And, you know, I'm not, I'm not somebody that's going to like back down from that. So then I sort of started creating this persona on the court, and there was a lot of head bobbing, a lot of trash talking. It was a lot like how Jack played in the NBA. Only I was just a fucking cocky white kid. You know what I mean? So everybody hated me. And, you know, by the end of my sophomore year, I was so distraught about it. And I had gone to a really bad place and had misbehaved. I would say I misbehaved my sophomore year. I tried to quit. I told my sisters I wanted to quit. Like, this was December of my sophomore year at Duke. I was like, this is not for me. It's not what I signed up for. And I had basically a come to Jesus moment with Coach K in late May of my sophomore year. I guess it was after my sophomore year, somewhere between sophomore and junior year. And he sat me down in the office and he just said, look, man, he's like, you've been good. Like, you know, you were all ACC last year and you were third team All-American. We made the Final Four. He's like, you've been good, but what you're doing isn't good enough. And Coach Collins, who's now at Northwestern, Chris Collins, Doug Collins' son, he said, I'll never forget. He said, the sad thing is we'll never know how good you can be. And I was like, fuck, that hurts. That hurts. And that summer, I had them make me a schedule to the hour. I still have the fucking spreadsheet in a notebook in my house. They had me to the hour, you know, 8 a.m. wake up, 8:30 breakfast, 9 a.m. check in with Coach Collins, 10 a.m. class. And it was down the line, you know, lifting, conditioning, basketball, court work, study hall, lights out, 10 p.m. And I had to carry a jug of water around the entire summer. I had to have like a gallon jug of water with me at all times.
Was that to replace the beer?
Yes, it was to replace the beer, 100%. If you guys want to know stories, I feel like this is the type of podcast where I tell stories
about
my sophomore year. But so as I'm walking around campus with a jug of water. So I did that all summer. They didn't let me play USA basketball. They're like, we want you here. We want you in our environment. And man, it was the best thing that ever happened for me. I lost like 23 pounds. I was over 215 at that time in May of my sophomore year. I started my junior year at like 192. I was in unbelievable shape. I won every preseason conditioning thing our team had that year. And I got National Player of the Year my junior year and ACC Player of the Year. We were undermanned squad. We ended up getting a number one seed in the NCAA tournament. We won the ACC championship, lost in the Sweet 16. Like, it was absolutely, that year was the turning point of my life. And it was all that jug of fucking water. That's all it was.
Hey, what was the NC and Duke rivalry like?
Oh, my gosh. I'm going to mix two stories here. I'm going to mix two topics. I know Matt wants to hear some stories. So the NCAA, the Duke-USC rivalry was crazy. There was nothing else like it. And, you know, growing up a Duke fan, you have such an appreciation for that rivalry. And my first time playing in it was a Duke game at home against UNC my freshman year. And the crowd was just different. The buzz, the energy was just different. And, you know, looking back, it feels like a game seven of a playoff game. And that's what a Duke UNC game feels like. My sophomore year, we're going to win the ACC regular season. We're the number one team in the country, us and UConn. We're basically number one or number two the whole season. So we're going to win the ACC. And it's the night before the Duke-UNC game, and it's game days there. So they got, like, the whole setup out in Shesterville. They got all the tents out there. Oh, it's popping. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I'm in my dorm room on West Campus, and I have a few friends over. We have a few beers or whatever. And so we get the idea that we should go down to Shesterville because that's where the party is tonight. This was a Friday night. It was a Saturday night game. So we go down there, and like I ended up playing beer pong with UNC fans. My roommates running through Krzyzewskiville, screaming at people, waking them up, making them take shots of Captain Morgan's.
Oh my goodness!
This is pre-cell phones with cameras. You know, this is pre-social media. Like I would have got fun. Like looking back, like I would have got kicked off the team. I would have been a wrap. It would have been a wrap.
Right. How did you play in that game, though? How did you play in that game that night,
not,
next night?
Not great in the first half. Not great in the first half. But I had a good second half. I ended up with 15 points and made the game-winning defensive play, believe it or not.
Oh, nice.
I stripped Rashad McCants and then dove on a loose ball, got fouled, and and hit the game-clinching free throws.
And iced.
Before we transition to the NBA, I wanted to touch on something because you faced it, you know, starting in college, and that's just the heckling you received. And I'm sure some of it you heard white boy this, white boy that, and I know you heard it a lot in the NBA. And you were someone when I talked about when this Montrezl Harrell and Luka thing came up, when he said something about bitch-ass white boy, and I was one to say that that's very commonly said. It's said a lot. You've probably been called worse.
Yeah.
What was your thought when that happened? Because I know you're someone that took a lot of it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And we used to mess around with you in the locker room and, you know, say you had black in you and all kinds of different things. So I just wanted to get a perspective, you know, your perspective on that, because there were so many different takes, and obviously we're in a heightened sense of, you know, awareness of what's going on in the culture in the country right now. But what was your take on that?
JJ wanted that shit. He wanted that shit. He welcomed it.
I told you, JJ's got black in it, but go ahead, JJ.
No, look, when you play high-level basketball, and you go back to AAU when I was 12 years old, I'm a white guy playing a black guy's sport. Like, that's reality. There's nothing racist about that. The majority of great players in the NBA are black, okay? The majority of great players in college are black. The majority of great players in AAU are black. I was one of the few white dudes on my AAU teams. Being called a bitch-ass white boy is something that I've heard since I was, like, 12 or 13. I laughed when Montrez said it. I was like, oh, shit. You know, I thought it was hilarious. But
right.
I also get we are in a time.
It's a different time, right?
We are in a time right now where everything is exposed, and you know, every little thing that's said is just so raw and the emotions are so high. So, you know, you take out the timing and I don't think it's that big of a deal, but I understood the reaction to it, whether it was talking heads or people on social media making a big deal of it. I understand. But, like, I just don't think there's reverse racism. I just don't think that exists. You can't say there's reverse racism towards white people. Like, white people in this country have controlled and dominated this country for 400 years. There's no reverse race. It doesn't exist. So I would say it's just normal on a basketball court. Like, to call somebody a white, you know, stupid white boy or bitch-ass white boy or punk-ass white boy, like, it's just normal.
I've heard someone call you a bitch-ass nigga, so I was one. Like, I wonder, like, if that's what he would have said. I've heard it. I wondered if that's what Montrez would have said, would people have tripped out if he said that to Luka instead of calling him a bitch-ass white? Because, like I said, I used JJ in this example when I was arguing, because I didn't hear JJ called everything. You know what I mean? And JJ shrugged it off, whether it bothered him or not. I never knew it. He shrugged it off. We always had running jokes that JJ had black in him, all this kind of stuff. So I was interesting for me. I knew when we finally got a chance to have a conversation about it, I wanted your perspective, because as I thought, just like I didn't think it was that big of a deal, but obviously the time and it's everything is about timing.
I think, and you guys have dealt with this too in your life, like, words definitely have power.
Yes.
I would say as athletes, we live in a high pressure environment constantly. We deal with performance anxiety constantly. We deal with ridicule and critique constantly. And so we're constantly barraged with words. Mm-hmm. And you do grow like an insensitivity in some ways to the words that are being said to you. And so the Duke experience for me, like, you can't say, someone has said something to me or one of my family members, you can't say anything else. There's no other words you can use to talk to me. Now, when you talk about specifically the N-word, right, and the use of that, that's where it's like, well, it's all kind of off limits to white people. Let's be honest. Like, that's not a word that ever should come out of any white person's mouth. You know, that's not a word in the vocabulary, you know?
Right.
So that's where it's like, there's certain words that carry more weight, and that's one of those words.
Hey, but I have to say this, though, and me being a real one, where I grew up and some of the places I hang around is some white people that grew up and have the same struggles, grow up with the same problems that black people grow up in, where they become family. And I've heard some white people address black people like that because they're comfortable like that, and the same, they've endured the same struggles growing up. You know what I'm saying? And some of those black people rely on some white people that they grew up with more than they can rely on their whole family. So I've heard some white people say, "What's up, my nigga," to people that they are related to. You know what I'm saying? But you have to come from these areas to understand that without thinking it's some racist shit.
I think, to me, that's a case-by-case, situation-by-situation experience. Because, you know, in similar ways, I've heard white people say it and get a pass and be okay with it. But, you know, overall, I definitely agree with you, JJ. It's not something that, you know, should be in a white person's vocabulary, but,
well,
you know,
Matt, you and I, we had a teammate with the Clippers who used to try to get me to say it to him. And I'd be like, nah, man. Like, nah, I'm not saying that shit. Nah. Because, like, yo, we're brothers. Yeah, okay, me and you are cool. But I say that to you around the wrong person. That word carries
some
of my weight.
Yes, someone might slap the shit out of you. You gotta watch it.
JJ's sick,
man. Fuck out of here, man.
He tried to
fuck out of here.
Hey, DeAndre was trying to set him up. Watch out.
Trying to set me up, man. Fuck DJ.
Hey, I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised who that was either.
At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. See for yourself when you sign up today and get $150 in bonus bets when you bet just $5. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment, it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER. Terms and conditions apply.
Parents, if you've ever experienced bedtime battles with the kids, I'm going to let you into a little secret. I'm Abby, a mother of two, and I had these battles myself. Endless excuses, delay tactics, and many tears and tantrums. But I've created a solution. The perfect kids podcast that makes bedtime a dream. It's called Koala Moon, and it's hosted by me, Abby. With over 300 episodes packed with original stories and sleep meditations, Koala Moon makes bedtimes easy and enjoyable. Episodes start out engaging and really rather magical, but as they progress, they gently slow to a calm and relaxing pace to have your little ones out like a light. Since launching in 2022, Koala Moon has helped with over 20 million nights sleep and received over 6,000 five-star reviews. Win back your evenings. Listen to Koala Moon now on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Parents, ready to discover a new educational and interactive podcast for kids? Join Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids, where episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, yes! We learned how to recycle at the beach.
That was great fun. Callie, what do you say?
It was. And that time when we did the science experiment and Billy made raisins dance.
That is so cool, Billy.
He did. Not to mention when a certain Elliot took up swimming classes with Lisa.
That was me.
Bet you can't catch me.
I'm going to get you.
All this fun and more in our Stories for Kids. Lingo Kids Stories for Kids is now available on StoryButton, the kid-friendly device for screenless podcast listening. Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
JJ, 11th pick in the draft in 2006, someone who was a college star, comes into the league scrapping and fighting for every minute possible. Year three, you guys run into LeBron. You guys knock out the Celtics minus KG, knock out the reigning MVP, LeBron James, and face Kobe and the Lakers in the finals. What was that like being on that stage and only your third year removed from college?
Man, some of the best memories of my career, to be honest with you. And that playoff run was really the turning point in my career because, you know, I came out of college with a lot of confidence. And I got punched in the mouth my first 2 years. I really got punched in the mouth. And to the point where, you know, that summer between my second and third year, I had to reshape my body. I had to basically redo my sophomore to junior year back at Duke all over again. And at that point, it was about survival and it was about sticking in the league. And I remember having conversations with my agent that summer, like, what would be options in Europe? Like, how does it work in Russia? You know what I mean? How does it work in Russia? Can I get a 3-year deal? So that playoff run, you know, I was finally like a rotation player, but there were still some nights where I got those DNP coaches' decisions, you know, and that playoff run, Courtney Lee broke his face in game 5 against Philly in the first round. So I started game 6, which was a closeout game in Philly on the road. And I hit 5 threes, played really well. Then I started the whole Boston series. I guarded Ray Allen the whole series. And then got to, you know, we beat Cleveland. I got to play against Kobe in the finals. So, you know, that to me gave me all the confidence. Like, I belonged in the NBA. You know, I remember distinctly, like, feeling in the Boston series, like, okay, like, this is it. Like, this is what I've been after for 3 years. You know, we're in Boston and KG was hurt and he's fucking screaming at me the whole game, you know, just obscenities from the bench. And I'm like, this is what I want. This is what I want.
Right.
You know,
hell,
I don't
want to
be all the way over there on the other bench, you know, in a suit like I was for most of my first 2 years. So that playoff run was a life changer for me. And truthfully, like, we all have Kobe stories, and I have a couple, like, more personal ones. But when I'm, like, 80, hopefully I'm still alive, but when I'm, like, 80, I'm going to tell my grandkids, like, I guarded Kobe Bryant in the NBA Finals. And, yes, he got the best of me, but I had some stops. I had some stops. Check the tape. Check the tape.
Are you counting stops when he passed the ball, or you actually stopped him?
Come on, man. Don't do that.
So the following year, you guys battle L.A., fall short to L.A. The next season, myself and Vince come. We have a great season. You play all 82 games. You were one of our consistent guys night in, night out. I've always kind of had a feeling of what happened, because if you remember, JJ, that's when we beat the shit out of Jack in Charlotte. We swept him and beat him by like 30 a game, and although Jack had a couple games where he got some points, we just beat the shit out of his team.
I was frying y'all ass, though. Y'all beat the shit out of us.
Beat the brakes off him. Then we destroyed Atlanta. And then, correct me if I'm wrong, didn't we go into the Eastern Conference Finals and Stan was on some shit like that? You know, this is a very... you know, veteran-driven team, we're going to have to switch a little bit of the offense up and completely fucking give our offense a facelift? Or was I just smoking too much weed back then?
Yeah, I think you've always been smoking too much weed. So, first of all, game 4 of the Charlotte series, we're up 3-0, keep in mind. And it's like the second quarter, and Jack makes a 3, and he's like, I'm still here. I'm still fucking here. Going back down the court. I'm like, man, your ass is about to get swept, man. Shut up. Jack, come on, man. You guys had no chance. All right, anyways.
He's right. You're 100% right. So you're 100% right.
Anyways. That's funny as hell.
I thought 2010, truthfully, was the best team that that was the best team I played on the NBA. Even though we made the finals in 09, our 2010 team was the best team I played on the
Loaded,
NBA.
Loaded, man.
Most games I've won in the NBA, we had a stretch where we were 33-8 to end the season, and then we went 8-0 in the playoffs. So we're going into that Boston series on a 41-8 run, beating the shit out of people. And I think, as oftentimes happen with really, really smart coaches and really detail-oriented coaches, is that they can get ahead of themselves. So it was almost like Stan adjusted before the adjustment needed to be made.
Before we had to.
Yeah.
Because then we beat them. We in the season series, we beat them 3-1, right?
Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
So we played well against them.
Yeah. And so they, you know, it was, you know, Tibbs was the defensive coordinator. It was all that strong side stuff, guy at the nail, weak side pulling all the way over. And Stan just felt like it wasn't in our best interest to run like a steady diet of high pick and rolls. So it wasn't that we were running
there,
like motion, but it was just more like side to side stuff. And looking back, like that's how everybody plays now, but it was like an adjustment on the fly that we had to make. And it just, you know, I don't necessarily think that it fit all of our personnel, if that makes sense. Like for me, it was great because I was like, oh, I don't want to get in a wrestling match with Tony Allen. you know, in a half court setting. But if you get me on the move and the ball's moving, okay, now I can attack a closeout and make a play.
Right.
So it was a great series for me, but I think for a lot of our guys, we hadn't played that way the whole year. So we get down 3-0, we win a couple games, and then we lose in game six. And, you know, Matt, I mean, I know you ended up winning one in Golden State, but it's like, you know, for me, I didn't realize that was going to be my, like, you know, 10 years later, that was my last chance. You know, that my last real chance that I've had. I'm under the assumption, like, oh, no, we'll be back next year. I think we had the best team in the league this year. We'll be back next year. And then LeBron and Chris Bosh and D-Wade go to Miami. And then as they're transitioning out, all of a sudden the Warriors come along. And so it's like those 2 years in Orlando where we had a legit chance to win, like, that was our window.
That window closed fast. That window, it closed fast.
It
closed really fast. You know, that I always say that was one of the most talented teams. We had a legit 10 guys that were ready to go to battle, to war anytime. We were too deep at every position. Stan was one of the best X and O's coaches I ever had, but I always felt like, and I remember when Shaq would say he would panic and get nervous, and I think you put it more elegantly. Obviously, I think he overthought the situation. We were adjusting before we even got into the situation. You know what I mean? We had success against them in the regular season, and we overthought our situation. And
You know, the one thing I would say, though, like, Stan, like, there's no perfect coach. I think Stan probably had a bigger impact on my career than any coach I've played for. Doc as well, because Doc was the first coach who let me be, you know, who looked at me as a starter and gave me more of a role in an offense. But Stan, you know, probably the best coach that I've played for in the NBA, you know, and I hate that Shaq had to say that about him, or, you know, that we have to sit here and talk about this, because I always felt like in a playoff series, I felt like Stan was going to get us a win. Like, he was going
super smart.
He was going to make an adjustment or come up with a game plan in game three or game four, or even steal one in game one. Like, I'm gonna do this and they're not expecting it. And it worked a lot of the time. And he would always get us a game just because, you know, he was so prepared and he worked so hard. He took such responsibility on what he could control. And he was great for that.
His attention to detail, second to none as far as coaches. He was – only thing I didn't like about Stan was our fucking tape shoot-arounds with knee pads. I'm like, damn, Stan, we can't cruise. Like, we have real – like, bro, we were taped with knee pads and shoot-around. It was unbelievable.
Hey, JJ, what was Matt like as a teammate?
I mean, Matt's just the same guy I'm talking to right now. You know, this is what I was talking earlier about, you know, reputation. Like, when people ask me, like, who are the best teammates you've had in your career? I'm like, well, Matt Barnes is definitely one of them. He was a great teammate. I think, you know, I saw this in Orlando, but it was a different group. When I got to LA, the way that him and DJ brought everybody together, like, if you were the 15th guy on that team, you felt like you were part of that team. It did. There was no like status on the team playing or status in the locker room. Like, they just had an amazing way of making every guy on that team feel special. And that was, I mean, that's rare, man. That just doesn't happen a ton in the NBA. And truthfully, like, that was a lesson that I learned, and I've taken that with me now as I've gotten older and I've done the mentor thing. Like, it's important to just involve everybody, because, you know, we get so caught up throughout a season, like, about what's going on with me. What's going on with me? I'm playing well. I'm playing bad. Whatever. And you got to keep in mind, like, there's three or four guys every night that leave that arena pissed.
Yeah.
Pissed. Because they didn't play, or they were in a suit, or, you know, they got their run in the first half but didn't get their run in the second half. And so, you know, doing the check-in with those guys, man, is important. And I think DJ and Matt were always great about that.
We've seen how important Dwight Howard has been along, you know, throughout these playoffs for the Lakers. I think for the whole season. I said at the beginning of the season when the Lakers signed Dwight, I think this was his make-or-break season. He could be done after this season if he didn't come with the right mindset. But I thought if he came with the right mindset, he'd be a huge asset for the Lakers. And he's come with the right mindset.
Yeah.
What have you seen from Dwight now? And can you just remind people, because how fast they forget, how fucking amazing Dwight Howard was when you played with him in Orlando?
First ballot Hall of Famer.
Yes,
no question.
Easy.
Should have won the MVP in 2011. It was the year after you left, Matt. But yep. He should have won the year Derrick Rose won it. Great story. And they were the number one seed. Great story. But Dwight was the most valuable person in basketball that year. He should have won MVP.
Yeah, he dominated.
What I've seen this year is just embracing a role that so many people wanted him to embrace for the last 4 or 5 years. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really hard. We all had good offensive seasons, you know, the three of us. But when you're a superstar and you're used to the ball going through you, I think it's really hard to make that adjustment to being a role player. It's just, it's unnatural. And most of us had to deal with that at an earlier age, right? Mm-hmm. Either in college or earlier in our NBA career, and it became about fitting in and maximizing a role and carving out a niche for yourself in the league. But when you start out as the number one guy, and then 10, 12 years later, they're like, we need you to dial it back a little bit. That's hard to do. And so you've seen it this year. He's just completely embraced, like, I'm going to defend my ass off. I'm going to grab every single rebound. I'm going to set hellacious screens.
Be a great teammate.
How strong is he?
He's been a great teammate all year.
How strong is he? People don't understand. That's probably the strongest dude I ran across in my career.
Unlike a switch, Matt, it's impossible to box him out.
Yeah,
it's definitely impossible. And he literally will toss people aside like a ragdoll.
Mm-hmm. It's ridiculous. I remember one time in Toronto, I think me, Vince, Jameer, and Rashad, he was shooting balls from half court like it was nothing. He was sitting down, and he was just doing something. We tried to jump him. When I tell you, he threw all of us off like I throw the Twins and Ashton off me. I was like, yo, this is crazy. This dude
he's been like that since high school, too. He's been built like that since high school.
Superman strong.
Yeah.
At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. Whether it's a walk-off grand slam or a base hit to center field. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment. It's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Parents, if you've ever experienced bedtime battles with the kids, I'm going to let you into a little secret. I'm Abby, a mother of two, and I had these battles myself. Endless excuses, delay tactics, and many tears and tantrums. But I've created a solution. The perfect kids podcast that makes bedtime a dream. It's called Koala Moon, and it's hosted by me, Abby. With over 300 episodes packed with original stories and sleep meditations, Koala Moon makes bedtimes easy and enjoyable. Episodes start out engaging and really rather magical, but as they progress, they gently slow to a calm and relaxing pace to have your little ones out like a light. Since launching in 2022, Koala Moon has helped with over 20 million nights sleep and received over 6,000 five-star reviews. Win back your evenings. Listen to Koala Moon now on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Parents, ready to discover a new educational and interactive podcast for kids? Join Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids, where episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, yes! We learned how to recycle at the beach.
That was great fun. Callie, what do you say?
It was. And that time when we did the science experiment and Billy made raisins dance.
That is so cool, Billy.
He did. Not to mention when a certain Elliot took up swimming classes with Lisa.
That was me.
Bet you can't catch me.
I'm going to get you.
All this fun and more in our Stories for Kids. Lingo Kids Stories for Kids is now available on Storybutton, the kid-friendly device for screenless podcast listening. Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Jack had a family emergency he had to tend to. JJ, it's me and you for the rest of the way. Let's pick off where we left off. I'm going to read some stuff to you just kind of about your career up to going from Milwaukee to the Clippers. So 2009 NBA Finals, lost to the Lakers. 2010, lose to Boston in the Eastern Finals. First round, 2011, lost to Atlanta. Second round, 2012, lose to Indiana. 13, Orlando goes into a rebuilding mode. You get traded to Milwaukee. What was it like for the first time in your career being traded?
It was an eye-opening experience. I think every player, when they get drafted, they think they're going to be in one place their whole career, but that works out for like less than 1% of all players. Right. There's the rare Nick Collison or Udonis Haslam of the world, but for the most part, even superstars,
right,
they move on. LeBron's played for basically four teams. So it's like, it's really, it was unrealistic. So I look back and I'm like, man, I was there 7 years. That's a long time to be in one place.
That's a long run. And absolutely,
when that rebuild first happened, like it was hard for me because, I was so used to winning and so used to a certain way that Stan had done things. And with a young coach, with Jacques Vaughn, who, by the way, let me play. Like, it was the greatest thing that happened to me, looking back. And a young team, we weren't going anywhere. But I had said to Rob Hennigan, I had said, like, look, I'm happy. I'm comfortable in Orlando. My wife's happy in Orlando. She grew up in Florida. Her family lives here. So, like, I'm cool being re-signing and coming back for the rebuild. I was a little shocked that I got traded. And I knew that it was a possibility. But, like, there were multiple times where, like, my agent had been like, yo, you're good, man. Deal's off. Like, this deal's off. Like, you're not going to get traded. And so, it was a situation where we're in Dallas the day of the deadline. We're flying to Memphis and we pull up to the airport, to the tarmac. Everybody starts getting off the bus. And Jacques was like, hang back. And he was like, me, Gustavo Ayon, Ish Smith, Josh McRoberts. And I think there was one other guy that was in a separate deal. So it was like five of us just hanging in the back. So I'm like trying to call my agent. And he's like, yo, I think maybe this Milwaukee thing is back on. And then Rob Hennigan called me at like 2:59. Deadline was at 3 p.m. He called me at like 2:59. It was like, hey, man, I just want to keep you in the loop. We've traded you to Milwaukee or whatever. And truthfully, I was emotional, man, because, Jameer was up there on the plane. And so many people, all the support staff, everybody that I'd spent 7 years with, Joe Rogowski and all these people that I'd spent 7 years with. And it was a tough day. But I woke up the next day and I'm like, all right, I'm gonna make the most of the Milwaukee situation. I had no idea sort of what I was walking into in that Milwaukee situation. But it all ended up working out because of that trade, I got a chance to really be a free agent, and Doc ended up getting traded as well to LA, and it was just a perfect, confluence of events that allowed me to get to, at the time, just a perfect spot for me. Like, it worked out perfectly.
So after leaving Milwaukee, you head to the Clippers. I get there a year before you. We have a very talented bunch. Doc comes in. You come in. You came in the same year as Doc, right?
Yeah. Yeah. About 2 weeks after him.
Right. So we have, now this is another team that I felt had the talent to win a championship. Yeah. Several reasons why we didn't. But what was it like coming to L.A.? So 7 years in with Orlando, which you felt like could be home for the rest of your career. Out of the blue, go to Milwaukee, which is a tough place to go. And now you're trading to
fine,
L.A.
Man. Milwaukee, don't shit on Milwaukee.
I'm not shitting on Milwaukee. I just said it was tough.
It's not even close to the top five worst NBA cities. Don't shit on
Milwaukee. It's not?
No.
Who would you put in front? Oh, well, let's talk about this, Rick. Who would you put? Oh, what cities are worse than Milwaukee? I'm confused. Because they're up there. I won't put you on the spot like that. So anyway, land in LA. Man. And like you said, Doc was someone who empowered you as a player. Like, you were one of our key pieces on the offensive end. What was it like being a part of, obviously, the Clipper franchise that hadn't had much success up to that point in coming in, establishing yourself as a go-to guy for our team?
No, it was amazing. It was like an amazing part of my career because I was in my prime athletically. I was still able to move all the ways I wanted to move. And I was playing with other great players. And the thing that I think gets overlooked about our group in LA was just how smart everybody was. Like we got to the point where we didn't really even ever call plays, like even set plays. It was all like hand signals and eye winks.
Read and react.
Y'all would bullshit with me about different ways to call 21 when we would call 21 and we'd call it, you know, whatever. We'd call it Chester after Chester Arthur, the 21st president. We'd call it Dion or Primetime after Dion Sanders. And then one time y'all started calling it Savage. And I had no idea what y'all were talking about. And you were like, 21 Savage. And I was like, who the fuck is 21 Savage? But no, and it was like, so like the part about that, like the basketball was just great. And off the court, you know, I had both my kids in LA. I grew up a lot. I mean, I went from like a kid to a man in those 4 years. And it was the best. I mean, it was the best 4 years that I could have had. I look back with that with, you know, a ton of love. And my regret, man, is like, we should have won. Like one God of those first two, damn. My first 2 years there, like, you know, your last 2 years there, we should have won. We should have won. Like we should have won. There's no, I think we were probably as good as anyone in 14. I think there's a chance we could have beat Golden State in 15, you know, as good as they were. Okay.
And then, they were young and coming up, like they were kind of.
And we had
not
beat them the year before in the playoffs.
Yeah, we saw them in our rear view, but we felt like that was our window still. We had maybe a 2 or 3 year window. We felt before it was Golden State's turn because we knew Golden State was coming. We battled in 7 games in the 14 season, and we knew they were on our way. In your opinion, what was it? Because like you said, our chemistry on the court was incredible at times.
Yeah.
Our chemistry off the court was even better. You know, the way we all hung out, our wives hung out, our kids hung out. We did stuff as teammates off the court. Like we really bonded as not only teammates, but friends and brothers.
Yeah.
But there was something in there that we couldn't get over that hump. In your opinion, what do you think it was?
Well, I think there's a couple things. And I've talked about this before, and I've used the word pettiness before, or petty. You know, there was some pettiness between some of us. Probably if you look back, and I've talked to enough of the guys now, like, we've all matured even more since then. And we all sort of realize what we squandered by being immature and petty at times. The other part of that is, you know, for whatever reason, I know you've said this before too, but the mental toughness, we would lose that at times. And it doesn't still make sense to me, because I think the makeup of all our guys, like I think CP is a champion. I don't know if CP is going to win an NBA championship. But in my mind, he's a fucking champion. Absolutely. He deserves a championship. He's that caliber of player. He's that caliber of competitor. He's a champion. And so, you know, it's still looking back. It's like it's probably those two things where, like, you know, if you look at the OKC series the first year where we're up 11 in game 5 at OKC and we make some boneheaded plays down the stretch and don't really execute. And we didn't bounce back from that. You know, we go back to game 6, we're up like 19 in the second quarter and Kevin Durant goes on a run. We don't bounce back from that. Like, you know, the next year when we're in that free fall with Houston, it was just like, you could feel it happening, you know?
For us to beat the defending champs.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? We knocked San Antonio out in the first round.
Yeah.
Like, this is our year. I think Clipper fans had the same feeling that year as they had this year. Like, okay, well, shit. This is the year that we're going to do it, you know? And I really felt like that. And we get up 3-1 against Houston and not really looking ahead, but we know Golden State is waiting on us. And those have kind of been like, I don't want to say little brothers because it was never that kind of situation, but they were on the rise and we were kind of the last team to knock them out of the playoffs. So we get to that situation. Houston sits James, and they make a miraculous comeback. And like I said, it was just a domino effect after that.
That game, how many times have you thought about the fourth quarter of that game? And just the different plays that happened. Josh Smith hitting 3 threes and Corey Brewer hitting a couple threes. And the other thing to think about that, and Blake and I talked about this one time. I remember that game 7. I was so tired. I think we underestimate how much that San Antonio series took out of
took
us.
And mentally and physically,
yeah,
though.
And we, yeah, exactly. And we didn't have, we weren't that deep. So, like,
no.
You look back at those box scores from the Houston series, and it's like 39 minutes, 45 minutes, 42 minutes. Our starters were playing heavy minutes. And I just remember that game seven, I don't ever get tired. And I remember feeling just exhausted coming out of timeouts, yeah. Coming, walking back on the floor. And Blake said the same thing to me. But that, I mean, look, there's no guarantee. I mean, look, it was the Eastern Conference Western Conference semis. There's no guarantee we beat Golden State, or there's no guarantee we beat, I guess it was Cleveland in the finals. But I certainly think those first 2 years that I was in LA, like those were squandered opportunities. And I think we had the personnel. I think we had the right coaches to get it done. And it just didn't happen, man. It just didn't happen.
Were you surprised to see that the Clippers decided to go a different direction with Doc just recently?
I was. In some ways, Matt, like I would have been really, as much as you're like jealous of your old team's success at times, you know, you leave a team and there's this period where you're like, man, I really don't want that team to win. You know, I don't want the Clippers to win. You know, that this year for me in Philly, I was conflicted at times because I love Joe and Ben and I love Tobias and I love Brett. But it was like, do I want them to win a championship without me? No, I'd be pissed. But I got to the point with LA where I'm like, right. Yo, like Doc's the last person there from our group. And, you know, I think it would have been really cool. And I know Clipper fans, like Clipper fans need a championship. Like they deserve a championship. They've been through so much.
They definitely do.
And, you know, so yes. I would have been really, truthfully, I would have been really happy for Doc and for Steve had that happened. And, you know, in many ways, it's a results based business, and you know, I thought they were going to at least give Doc one more year, and just you know, play next year with PG and Kawhi and again coming back. But yeah. Man, it's tough for him, and I'm sure you know. I've been on Hoopsite the last 2 days. I know he's got suitors, and he'll
got some big options
getting somewhere.
And one option is your former team. What was it like? Because I love Philly. I think through management, they've taken steps back, starting when they went, you know, they decided to give Tobias, with all due respect, you know, pick Tobias over Jimmy, if that was the case. I don't know, let go of you. To me, they had a lot of talent and surrounded you with some dead-eye shooters, and that's normally the recipe in the NBA to win a championship. What was it like playing with those two young stars?
It was awesome because both of them are so intelligent and competitive. You know, if you look back at how you were night to night at 23, 24, like those guys to me, like bring it on a consistent basis and they're fun to be around. I've said this before, but the one consistent in Philly has been personnel in and out. Like, they just have a ton of players that come through there. And so I think, and Joel talked about this on my podcast, like for him, he's played with, I don't even fucking know at this point, hundreds of teammates, you know? It's just it's a rotating cast. And so I think in the NBA, we don't really value continuity as much as we should. There's no two-man, you know, game like Stockton and Malone that goes on for 15, 16 years. Like, we just don't see that anymore. I would love to see them. Those are two young guys. They're both all NBA players. Like, I would love to see them figure out a way to bring in a coach that can get the best out of them and to surround them with great personnel. Yeah, I mean,
can look, they win together? Can they win they, together? They Do you fuck, feel like
they
those
fucked
two?
Up not bringing me back, man. They fucked up. Not bringing me back.
I agree. I completely agree. I agree 1,000%, and that's what people are like. Like, you're not a star, but you are a glue, consistent guy that knocks down shots, and you need that, especially with those two players. Like, you need someone that's going to give some spacing to the floor, someone that comes in and just does his job night in, night out. And that's why I say I blame a lot of that. It was that Elton Brand that took over as the GM, and he's been making these moves that have kind of been like, hold on, bro, you were a player. Why are you trading away all your shooting? Like, what the fuck are you doing?
You're an inactive player. I'm an active player. So, I would just say, I think they probably realized they needed a little more shooting. The thing with me and Philly, though, like it wasn't just about the shooting. You know, it was
Oh, leadership, I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, look, like, you need people in the locker room. Like, you just need those guys. And and I'm friends. Like, I literally was texting with Ben and Joe the other day. So, like, it's, so much of this is, you know, we don't consider the relationship part of it as much as we should. And
we need to.
It's unfortunate, man. And I've said this before, you know, in talking about our days with the Clippers. Like, it changed after you left. You know, you left after 2015. Like, our team wasn't the same. The chemistry wasn't the same. The locker room wasn't the same. And I know, look, I know you were older at the time, and you got you know, some coin or whatever. So it's not like one thing or another, but it hurts to lose, like, the vocal present, the leadership, your friend, like, those things hurt in this business. And not enough people talk about that, man. Like, the makeup of a team on the court, on paper, with this guy at this position, this guy, that's one thing. But the makeup of a team and how everybody, you know, coincides and works together, that's a whole other thing. And you got to have the right personalities.
Like you said, that's definitely not talked about enough in today's game. But 2019, you signed a two-year deal with an up-and-coming, one of the most exciting teams in the game. You get a young Zion, fresh out of college, and someone who I love, the guy that won Most Improved, Brandon Ingram, and also get a Lonzo Ball. What has that experience been like? Now you're the old man in the locker room. What is it? What's that? Obviously, kind of looking, not necessarily looking back at your career, but it goes by so fast. Now you're the voice of reason. You're the old man with all the ice on you. What has it been like in that locker room with that team?
Man, it's been great, to be honest with you. This year, other than COVID and the bubble, my actual time in New Orleans was one of the least stressful, least drama-filled teams I've ever been on. It's just a bunch of good dudes, man. And when they're good dudes already at 21 or 22, like, I feel like if you get the right vets around them, you can really have an impact on their career.
Special.
And look, that's what happened to me. Like, you know, I was very fortunate that I was in great locker rooms in Orlando. And we had guys like Keon Dooling and Rashard Lewis and you. Like, we had Vince. Like,
Vince.
We had good
Anthony
dudes.
Anthony Johnson, yeah.
We had good dudes, man. So I think you think a lot about, like, your own legacy when you get towards the end of your career, and, like, what it means, and, like, how people are going to remember you. And, like, I hope I was a good teammate. I hope Nikhil Alexander Walker's like, yo, that's my guy. I hope in 15 years when he's finishing up his career and he's doing the same thing to a 22-year-old, he can say, oh, yeah, you know, JJ took care of me when I was a rookie. And those are the things that you really think about when you get older. And I would say this, too, like, man, as a visiting player, you know, you go to New Orleans, you fly in, you stay at the Rich, you might walk, like, a block or two to dinner. You don't ever get to experience what New Orleans really is. New Orleans is a special place, man. It's one of the most amazing places I've ever been in this country. It's so unique. The people there are just insanely nice and insanely great. And I think that was eye-opening to me. Because I didn't know what to expect. Because, again, I had experienced one hotel and, like, two restaurants and the arena for 13 years. Mm-hmm. That's it. And then they got a jazz hall that's open almost every night. You can go see a brass band play at a random dive bar on a Monday. You know, Mardi Gras. My 6-year-old is, like, still talking about Mardi Gras. That was in February. Knox, what was your favorite thing about New Orleans? Mardi Gras. My best day of my life, Dad. Best day of my life.
Hopefully you didn't get to see some girls doing wild things for beads.
No, well, there's the Bourbon Street Mardi Gras, and then there's the uptown family-oriented Mardi Gras. Yeah, no, Knox.
See, I don't know. You gotta school me. I didn't know what you were showing Knox already. I was about to ask.
Uptown is, like, you know, it's a different part of New Orleans than what we're talking about. With, you know, Knox was not out in the streets, man. Come on.
He wasn't throwing beads. Drew Holiday, one of the most underrated two-way players in the game. Talk to me a little bit about him, because he's someone you just don't hear much about, but he's put together a very solid and one of the most respected players in the game.
Drew doesn't ask for or enjoy adulation and attention. He's totally cool, just flying under the radar. He and his family are just incredible people. His wife, Lauren, is a phenomenal woman. They're just, you know, his brothers, him, his parents, like they're just leaders. They're just great people. And, you know, I think my two biggest takeaways from my year in New Orleans was, thank God I got to experience New Orleans and what a special place it was. And thank God I get to be friends with Drew Holiday, because like you, man, like he's somebody in 10 years, 15 years, whatever it may be, like we're still going to be friends, man. He's just an incredible human. He's an incredible human. You know, on the court, like he does so much and he does so much well. And I've talked about this a ton on my podcast. I've talked about it with the guests on my podcast, but seeing him guard the ball up close, one-on-one, in person this
special.
Year.
It's special.
There's no one that can do what he does. Mm. I don't know how he is able to just stay in front of people at the level that he can. And it doesn't matter. Like, you want to put him on Dame Lillard, great. You want to put him on,
don't matter who
put
it
him
is,
on Jokic,
right.
Great. And like, we'll switch him on Jokic and he'll be like, nah, don't give me help. Don't get, like, he wants that action.
Right.
And that's dope. He's just great, man. And like, again, like another guy, like we talk about, you know, having the right mix of guys in the locker room. Like, he's just a special dude in the locker room, man. He's just a great teammate.
What do you see, God willing, Zion stays healthy? Is there a limit you can put on him? Because I don't think we've ever seen anything like him.
No, there's not. Like, it's all NBA, All-Star, Hall of Fame. That's his ceiling. Mm. Like, the thing with Zion is that he is naturally, obviously athletic, but naturally skilled. And so when he learns sort of how to play the NBA game and think the NBA game, he's going to dominate. Like, he does it naturally without even really putting the thought and the preparation that we all learned. Like, I didn't do this either when I was 19.
It's a process.
Yeah, it's a process.
That's what people
say. I'm like, dude, this guy in year five and year six,
trouble.
What are we looking at right now?
He's 2010, and like you said, he's just playing off raw instinct and ability and athleticism. It takes a good 4 or 5 years to you understand the NBA game. So once he understands the NBA game, like I said, as long as he stays healthy, ooh-wee. Yeah.
And I saw that this year with B.I. and Brandon. You know,
love him.
B.I. in his fourth year, Lonzo in his third year. And you could see that development, like where they're thinking the game and where they're learning, like, oh, this is where my advantage is. I can get away with this almost every night. And let me keep going to that. And so that's, like, to me, as much as we talk about skill development, that's where really great players, that's where the development happens, is in thinking the game. And that's what makes one of our teammates, Chris, so great. Like, that's why he can play at the level he can at 35 as an undersized point guard. It's because he's absolutely so smart and he thinks the game.
Old man in the 3-point podcast. What has that experience been like? Because stepped in the podcast game in 2015, and I didn't even know what a podcast was. I remember you interviewed me, I think, right after I left the Clippers. Yeah, yeah. And I just like, what is this, JJ? And he said, it's a podcast. And like, you've kind of, so you're almost a veteran in the game now, obviously just stepping away and starting your own platform, by the way, congratulations.
Thank you.
After a good run with the Ringer.
Yeah.
What has that experience been like for you?
It's been awesome, man. You know, I started, I guess like almost 5 years ago, you know, with my first podcast, with Yahoo, and did 3 years with the Ringer. Obviously, I left on good terms with the Ringer and with Bill. I was very transparent about what we were trying to do in terms of just owning the podcast and owning the IP and owning the platform. You know, so much of what we're trying to do as players now is just ownership. You know, it's about owning what we do, and so it's been fun, but it's been a lot of work. And we've been on a 2-episode streak now for over 2 months, like where we're doing 2 episodes a week. And, you know, we're doing calls on IP stuff, on trademarks, on merch, you know.
So your hands in on all that.
All of it, man. And Tommy, my co-host and my partner on this venture, is obviously on it with me. We're hopefully getting ready to hire someone to help us just with logistics or whatever. But it's fun, man. And like, look, we talk about, like, you know, being basketball players and simultaneously, like, being content creators. Like, I'm doing 3 hours of content a week. Like, I never thought I'd be in this situation. The thing with Old Man and the Three, our new podcast, it's been amazing, is just the guests that we've gotten. And so much of what makes a podcast great, you got to be a good host or whatever, but you need great guests. And I think because I'm not traditional media, and this is how you and Jack operate too, like, because y'all are not traditional media, like Allen Iverson will come on your show. D-Wade will come on my show. Kevin Durant will come on my show. You know,
Let their guard down.
We're releasing an episode tomorrow with Melo. So like, these are people that like guys don't necessarily get to hear from other than the post-game quote or the stuff that they're putting out on their own, which is all, you know, whatever. This is like a real conversation like we just had just now. And that's, I think, what is the most enjoyable thing about podcasting for me is just the long form content. You can really dive deep on stuff and get a glimpse into somebody's psyche, into their inner workings. Like it's just fascinating to me.
I tell people, like, we've, as athletes, we've been trained our whole life to give it all physically. And obviously some mental comes with that. But I think my transition to my post career, having an opportunity to work with ESPN, have an opportunity to work with Showtime and iHeart, this mental exhaustion is a fucking monster. Like, I'm finished after, you know, I have to host a few podcasts or I have to do a bunch of stuff on ESPN. Yeah. And it's a whole different kind of tired. Then on top of that, I still got to chase my kids around. You have to do the same thing. Yeah. But it's different. And I have a whole new respect for this lane because I got to do it at the highest level and physically exhaust everything I had in my body as a professional athlete. And now transitioning into this media space, this mental wear down and mental exhaustion is just different. And it'll literally put you to sleep. Like
there's done. Some days I'm with you. There's some days I'm like grasping for air. I am like trying to come up out of the dirt just to get a breath. And some of that too, I mean, if you're a parent and you're an active, involved day-to-day, like I'm with my kids and we're doing stuff. I'm taking them to school. I'm picking them up from school. And you're sort of managing that. And then you're managing, you know, for me as a still an active player, like you're managing that part of playing. And then you're also, there's this mental fuckery that happens every day where you're like, all right, you know, I didn't anticipate having to answer 20 emails every single day nonstop for the last 2 months. Like, I didn't anticipate that. 3-4 conference calls a week. Like, I didn't anticipate that. I thought I was just going to, all right, you know, just give me the guest. I'll do the interview. And so that part of it actually, as exhausting as it's been, has been super fun because you do feel like...
Because you enjoy it. You still enjoy it and you're learning.
You're owning it and you're building it. And it's a total learning process. Totally. I never knew some of this stuff before. And so it's been really awesome.
How do you feel like this side of obviously podcasting has kind of helped you find your footing and your voice? Because, you know, it's no secret you have maybe a couple years left in the game until you feel like you want to step away. But find your voice post-career, but then also find your voice in this social justice space because you've been very adamant and spoken very eloquently about things that are going on in this country.
There's only so much that you can express in a coherent way on Twitter. And so allowing or using the podcast, you know, even going back to 2016, when I talked about Colin Kaepernick, I had William C. Roden on, who was a longtime sports columnist for the New York Times, who wrote the book, The $40 Million Slave, talking about professional athletes. Like, talked about Kevin Durant leaving the Warriors then, said there was a little bit of the visceral reaction was tinged in some form of anger at a black person taking control and ownership of his career. Still stand by that today. Like, I've used this platform, I think, in a good way. Because my podcast is not about silly jokes and shit. Like, I'm gonna be dry and sarcastic, and we'll probably have a laugh or two. But, like, I want this to be something that you get something out of, that it provides some insight behind the curtain. And
absolutely.
And when all this stuff started happening, whether it was COVID initially, you know, we talked a ton about COVID. We talked about some of the mandates and being serious about that. Now we're on voting, you know, and so are you. And so it gives you an opportunity to speak out and talk in a coherent way where Twitter is just a bunch of people shouting at each other. And it's not a real platform. It's just an echo chamber. And so, you know, I think, too, it's like when we had Cuban on the podcast, like I asked him things that he's an independent. He has no party affiliation. And to get his perspective on things, it was great to hear. It was eye-opening. I think that's the thing with the podcast is you can constantly learn. When we had Taylor Rooks on the podcast, she said a couple things that were like, never heard that before. Great. Unbelievable insight.
That's dope. Hell yeah.
Yeah, so that's what I think I've enjoyed the most about it is just, you know, as basketball players, the best basketball players are students of the game. They're constantly learning. And so as human beings, like, why would we not have that same responsibility? You know, we should be lifelong learners. And the podcast is a great platform to do that.
Absolutely. Top five shooters of all time. You can include yourself or you cannot include yourself.
Steph, Clay, Ray, Reggie, Kyle Korver.
Okay. Or where are you? Do you put yourself? I know you don't like talking about yourself. Where do you put yourself? Are you top 10 in your opinion?
Yeah. I mean, look, you talk about efficiency and volume. I'm top 10. Yes. I'm top 10.
Okay. I like that. Your dream starting lineup with players you've played with over your career?
Tough. All prime, like prime Chris Paul.
Yes, prime everybody.
Okay, so prime Chris Paul, prime Vince Carter.
Ooh.
Prime Blake Griffin.
Ooh.
Prime Dwight. Yeah, that's tough. The Dwight or Joe argument's tough. Then it's like, because Chris is so good, I'll just throw Ben Simmons in there, man, honestly. I was going to say like prime that. Rashard or Hidoo, but I'll throw Ben in there. So Ben, Chris, prime Vince, prime Blake, prime Dwight. And six-man Joel Embiid, no doubt.
JJ Redick, we appreciate your time, man. Thank you. Continued success. Give my best to your family. Good luck next season, man. Looking forward to you guys making your introduction to the playoffs with that young team. And I'll catch up with you, my man.
Thanks, guys. All right, Matt.
All right, good to see you. All right. That's a wrap. All the Smoke with our guest, JJ Redick. You can catch this on Showtime Basketball YouTube and iHeart. See you guys next week.
This is All the Smoke, a production of The Black Effect and iHeart Radio in partnership with Showtime.
At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. See for yourself when you sign up today and get $150 in bonus bets when you bet just $5. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment, it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER. Terms and conditions apply.
Parents, if you've ever experienced bedtime battles with the kids, I'm going to let you into a little secret. The Koala Moon podcast has revolutionized over 20 million bedtimes, with parents like you calling it life-changing and the perfect nighttime routine. With original kids' bedtime stories and cozy sleep meditations, every episode has been specially designed to make bedtimes a dream. Listen to Koala Moon on the iHeartRadio app, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Discover a new educational and interactive podcast, Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids. Our episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, yes! We went shape hunting around the block, and we found spheres and cubes on the street.
That was great fun. Join Stories for Kids, the Lingo Kids podcast, inspiring you to learn while having fun. Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.